You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Morning on a Tuesday. The second day of summer vacation. So I'm doing some research, right? In conjunction with the program. The whole Iran thing has me kind of interested in different things, right? It takes me to different places. So, so welcome to my house on a Tuesday. Anyway, I want to talk about, like, first of all, a treaty doesn't become anything in the United States according to the Constitution unless it's ratified, right? So you as the president, you go put your name on something, or the Secretary of State signs something. What does that mean? Answer, nothing. It's the signal of an administration of its intent. Now, the list of unratified treaties that the United States has is amazing. And go do a search on it. It's amazing. Paris Agreement, signed but not ratified. That's 2017. 2016, Trans-Pacific Partnership, signed but not ratified. 2013, Arms Trade Treaty, signed but not ratified. 2011, Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, signed but not ratified. 2008, Convention on Cluster Munitions, not signed. 2007, Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, signed but not ratified. 2006, International Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearance, not signed. 2002, Optional Protocol on the Convention Against Torture, not signed. 1999, Civil Law Convention on Corruption, not signed. So, you look at this whole thing, right? The United States withdrew from a treaty. We didn't withdraw from a treaty. We withdrew from something that Barack Obama was famous for, and that is executive orders. So, and a treaty that's never... Okay, so let me lay out the path of a treaty. We'll do a little civics class here. Because I had to do it for myself. All right, first some basics, right? You hear JPOA, right, which is a joint plan of action, right? That's a framework for the Iran nuclear deal, right? So that's what you hear, JPOA, right? You also hear the term P5 plus 1. What does that mean? That means the permanent five members plus Germany. All right. The permanent five members are the U.S., the U.K., France, China, Russia, and then Germany. So P5 plus one. Right. So there you have it. So that was the deal. Now, just the legal. I got this from a website that bears Dag Hammarskjöld name, former UN Secretary General back in the day, right? Title, Signature Subject to Ratification. Where the signature is subject to ratification, I guess would be in all forms of government other than dictatorships, except then I would think dictators... They're not bound by shit. But anyway, that's just me. Where the signature is subject to ratification, acceptance, or approval, the signature does not establish the consent to be bound. However, it is a means of authentication and expresses the willingness of the signatory state to continue the treaty-making process. Right? So it signals intent, if you will. The signature qualifies the signatory state to proceed to the ratification, acceptance, or approval. It also creates an obligation to refrain in good faith from acts that would defeat the object and the purpose of the treaty. So it signals intent, and if you sign it, you're expected to abide in spirit by this till it's ratified. And in the United States, in most cases, it's never ratified. All right. Now, let's talk about the United States. In most countries, treaties are ratified by a vote of parliament or by an executive decision. So, parliament would be some form of representative democracy, executive decision in all other forms thereof. They then supposedly have the force of law, but few countries have means of citizens' enforcement of such laws, which is why they can safely ignore those treaties when it's convenient. The United States isn't like that. Thus, Western European nations are mostly quite happily failing to get anywhere near on target for their Kyoto Protocol commitments. Right? So you sign it, it has the weight of fairy dust. The U.S. Constitution, by contrast, right, says the following relative to treaties. Article 2, the President shall have the power by and with the advice and consent of Congress to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. Okay, so you can make a treaty, but two-thirds of the Senate have to approve it. Two-thirds. Okay? Two-thirds. Article 6. The Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, so there you go, this Article 6, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. So, the president can only make treaties with the consent of two-thirds of the Senate. So, and then just here's a little anecdote to the side. Clinton signs the Kyoto Agreement, right? The Senate votes preemptively 95-0 against consenting to any treaty that was agreed to along Kyoto's lines. But Clinton signed it anyway. So what did it mean? It meant nothing. It meant a photo opportunity. All right. So when a treaty is ratified, it's the law of the land. It is the law of the land. All right. Now, so fast forward to the Iranian thing. What, pray tell, is going on with that whole mess? And I found an interesting piece from a couple of years ago, actually from about 4 years ago, and written in July of 2015, the down and dirty on the Iran nuclear deal. And I thought it's a pretty decent kind of, you know, walk through this stuff. So I want to walk through it with you. It's about, might be 2 pages, so bear with me, because it's pretty good as this stuff goes. All right. Written by a guy named Aaron Stein. Now, I don't know who Aaron Stein is. Somebody's going to probably write me and say, Mac, that guy's a communist. Alright, listen to what he has to say. Alright, so now remember, this was written in 2015. Today, the P5+1 and Iran reached agreement on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The agreement's provisions expand upon the U.S. fact sheet released after the previous rounds of nuclear negotiations with Iran, which concluded last April, which would have been April of 2015. The strength of this agreement centers on its robust monitoring of the front end of the Iranian nuclear fuel cycle for 25 years. The agreement is structured around the monitoring of Iran's uranium throughput and so-called downstream activities related to enrichment. Now, this gets a little bit into the enrichment process, but if you want to understand the agreement, you got to go there, all right? These safeguards are in excess of Iran's voluntary implementation. Okay, whenever you see voluntary implementation, roll your eyes. Of the additional protocol, an inspection regime designed to strengthen the International Atomic Energy Agency's monitoring of nuclear facilities. While much of the focus has been on breakout, now, the term breakout's significant, okay? So, it's defined as this. The time it would take Iran to enrich 25 kilograms of 90% uranium-235. Okay? That's what breakout is, okay? Now, we're going to go into the weeds on breakout, so stay with me. The reality has always been the current inspection regime would, in all likelihood, detect this activity in short order. So, if they went beyond what they would make for energy purposes. The inspection regime, which seems to work nowhere, would detect that. Okay. It then becomes, and this is an aside, it then becomes a matter of how often would you inspect and how fast can they convert, right, that uranium into weapons-grade uranium. Okay? So, stay with me now. The quick detection of such a diversion of uranium would almost certainly have prompted the tightening of sanctions or the use of military force to destroy the elements of Iran's nuclear fuel cycle, even before the conclusion of the JCPOA. To be clear, breakout time is not an irrelevant metric. Instead, it needs to be put into context, particularly how Iran's continued installation of centrifuges before conclusion of the first JPOA in November of 2013 placed limits on Iran's enrichment program. The overarching limits were premised on real concerns about Iran's nuclear program and its growing enrichment capacity. Okay, so you grow your enrichment capacity, you shrink the time it takes for you to create what you need to make a bomb. Okay. Bear with me. The article goes on. For a relatively accurate understanding of Iran's nuclear status in October of 2013, one needs only to look to the bomb cartoon Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu used as a prop during his speech to the United Nations in 2012. Let me tell you one thing Netanyahu's great at. He is great at dumbing down stuff, right, with a big-time visual, and he did it when the Mossad yoked up Iran's nuclear warehouse, what, a year or two ago? That was hilarious, okay? But he's great at theater in terms of taking a complex issue and put it in front of everybody, and so there's the picture in the article shows Netanyahu at the UN. He's got a white board, and on the whiteboard that he's holding in one hand is a bomb, like you would see in like Natasha and Boris cartoons. So it's a round bomb with that rectangular like fuse opening at the top, and then like a fuse that's lit at the end. Okay, and he's standing there with a red pen. Okay, so that's what I'm going to describe. The cartoon accurately claimed that Iran had done 70% of the work to produce 25 kilograms, one significant quantity of HEU, or the amount of weapons-grade uranium needed for a relatively crude first-generation nuclear core. This metric was based on the performance of Iran's IR-1 centrifuges and its stockpiling of 20% enriched uranium. All right. Bear with me. I know it's tedious, but bear with me. Natural uranium is primarily made up of two isotopes, uranium-238 and uranium-235, with the latter accounting for 99.2% of the element's isotopic configuration. Yeah. For simplicity, a nuclear weapon requires uranium enriched above 80%, whereas most reactor designs use fuel enriched to 5%. The enrichment is the process of removing U-238 through the spinning of the centrifuges. So we spin U-238, and what we're left with is enriched uranium. Thus, by enriching to 20%, Iran has removed much of the U-238 isotopes, which means that it requires less work and time to remove the remaining U-238 from stockpiled 20% enriched uranium. Okay. So, what Netanyahu rightly points out in his picture, is 70% of the work of making the bomb, right, is getting to 20%. Going from 20%, right, to 90% is the next stage, which is another 20% of the work. So 70% of the work is already done. The concern, therefore, was that Iran would be able to enrich to weapons grade in less than a month, or in between IAEA, International Atomic Energy inspections, right? This would have certain definitions of nuclear armed rendered Iran a nuclear weapons state, or to quote Ehud Barak, right, former prime minister of Israel, they would have entered the zone of immunity, wherein a military strike on Iranian facilities would fail to destroy the enriched uranium, right, needed for the core of a nuclear weapon, because it would already exist. For these reasons, the main thrust of the first JPOA in November 13th centered on Iran's halting of 20% enriched uranium and the decrease in its stockpile of low enriched uranium, which it did in January 2014, allegedly. When you take those things together, those two provisions extended the breakout time to about a year, whereas before November 2013, it was 2 to 3 months. Pretty amazing, right? Pretty amazing. The JCPOA has locked this breakout time in place for 10 years through the capping of Iran's centrifuge numbers. So it's kind of an engineering cap, right? If you only have this many centrifuges, you could only get this much throughput in a year. So the requiring of Iran to decrease its stock, 20% stock, below 300 kilograms, and provisions relating to the production of uranium gas, the material that is fed through the centrifuge. All right. Stay with me now. Stay with me. So you can see the engineering problem, right? The Israelis look at it and say, based on their stockpile, based on the number of centrifuges, they can do it in less than a month. And how often are you going to inspect? Every 90 days? That doesn't work for us. All right. The article goes on. The agreement also includes an inspection regime written, it seems, to address concerns about Iran's past nuclear weapons program. It is incredibly difficult to detect a clandestine centrifuge program, owing the facility's small footprint and the small amount of power required to spin centrifuges, which begs the question, hey, so what if they just ignore it? What if they start a second site that we don't know about? The United States has largely failed in its effort to detect such facilities in the past, with a key exception, the Islamic Republic of Iran. This suggests that the program has been penetrated by intelligence services. Regardless, the agreement leaves little to chance and has built-in inspection regimes to ensure that Iran cannot build a small, undeclared enrichment plant to support a dedicated nuclear weapons program. The JCPOA requires that Iran accept monitoring on centrifuge production facilities for between 20 and 25 years. Per the agreement, Iran will declare the location of its flow-forming machines, the specialized tool needed to form the rotors used for gas centrifuges. In other words, the P5 plus 1 will have a complete list of where Iran makes centrifuge components and where the equipment needed to do so is stored, and will then be able to monitor these areas for 20 years. It is in addition to the deals requiring Iran to allow monitoring of its uranium mines for 25 years. Okay, so that's the outline of the deal. About three more paragraphs. The monitoring is designed to prevent sneak out or the clandestine development of a second undeclared fuel cycle for a nuclear weapons program. These provisions allow for the IAEA to account for the amount of uranium mined and milled, compare it to the amount converted into uranium gas, then compare that amount with UF6 that shows up in a city by the name of Natanz, before monitoring and then measuring the amount of enriched uranium. This renders the debate about the 10-year sunset on some centrifuge production restrictions moot. After the 25-year expiration of these provisions come off, Iran will still be beholden by its expected future ratifications of the additional protocol and critically modified Code 3.1. Blah, 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 blah. All right. This means the United States can have confidence that it will detect the diversion of equipment or fissure material in near real time for at least 25 years before those inspection provisions expire, leaving only the additional protocol. It also helps strengthen the military option should Iran fail to live up to its commitments. Iran's accounting for and allowing of monitoring of its centrifuge workshops actually helps with targeting. In the case of North Korea, for example, it is unclear that the United States actually knows where its enrichment program is located, decreasing the credibility of a strike on its nuclear facilities because the confidence that the program would be sufficiently damaged would be in doubt. Iran will give the United States this information, and the IAEA will monitor it. In real time, arguably, this would increase the credibility of the military option, owing to the fact that the United States would be assured of destroying much, if not all, of the critical components needed to enrich uranium. You know, my problem with all of this is that dictatorships don't, I mean, when have we seen anybody not pursue a nuclear weapon that got close to it? I just don't believe, you know, I sit here and I, you know, as you go through the footnotes to all this stuff and you're trying to get your head around what this agreement was supposed to do, you're going to make this deal with Iran and you're going to believe that somehow or other they're not going to either import, buy on the market from North Korea, or in some way, shape, or form get their hands on enough plutonium, on enough enriched uranium to go ahead and weaponize that. I just find that folly. All right. Now, here's one of the things that I found in the article that was most interesting, and the reason I decided to use it this morning. To be clear, this agreement does nothing to address the regional issues related to Iran's policies in Iraq and Syria. The Iraqi and Syria files do not appear to be in control of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Office of the President, the two key bureaucracies that have pushed for the conclusion of a nuclear agreement with the West. So it's kind of and again, I'm not up on my internal Iranian. I believe Iran operates as one entity, but the article suggests that it operates as two. You have the president and the foreign ministry trying to negotiate a deal relative to the nuclear program, which evidently the federal government runs. What the article says is that the Iraq and Syria files aren't run by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the federal government. They're run by the Republican Guards. The article goes on. More conservative factions appear to be running Iran's numerous wars in the region, casting further doubt about the goodwill from the nuclear deal spilling over and changing Iran's calculus in the region. So you have this duality that exists inside of Iran. And so to me, when you look at this, I mean, all right, let me finish it. Instead, what it does do is remove the specter of a nuclear Iran that has the capability to coerce its neighbors by threatening to quickly enrich enough material for a nuclear weapon. This means that the United States and its European allies should refrain from casting this agreement as a prelude to discussions about Iran's role in the region. So, what the article's saying is, yeah, this agreement is simply a nuclear agreement and cannot be connected to their larger behavior in the region. Where I think if you asked any American what they think, they would say, no, that's Iran acts as one, right? We don't see Iran acting, you know, in this, you know, duality, in this stereo world. The Arab Gulf states are intensely skeptical of Iranian policy in Iraq and Syria, viewing it as part of a broader effort to cement Iranian dominance in the Gulf region. Beyond concerns about Iranian nuclear capabilities, some in the Gulf view the easing of sanctions as a prelude to increase funding for Iranian-backed groups in the region, most of which are fighting against rebel groups allied with the Gulf states. The Arab discontent, therefore, is not nuclear-specific, but tied to other issues related to the easing of Iran's nuclear-related isolation. The deal will not fix these dynamics, requiring the United States to balance its interest in non-proliferation with its regional allies concerns about backing Iranian backing for rebel groups and militias. So if you sat down and roundtable this and said, okay, here's what we have. On one side, we're balancing Iranian nuclear ambition with this JPOA. And on the other, it's the regional, right, acting here in the region. Now, what this is going to do is this is going to restrict, you're trying to sell this to them. This is going to restrict their ability to use your nuclear weapon to threaten you all. But what will happen is their economy will rise. The United States will unfreeze this cash for Iran, and that will likely be funneled into efforts to further destabilize the region and empower their proxies. Can you imagine being a Gulf state listening to that? You'd be pissed. Hey, I say you do nothing. I say don't sign this and let the Israelis deal with the Iranians. You could hear that being said, right? The last paragraph. A more pronounced regional reapproachment would require the Gulf Arab states deciding that Iran had changed its behavior rather than simply agree to an intrusive inspection protocol. The United States would thus be wise to temper expectations in the coming weeks. In the near future, there will certainly be implementation issues and the regional dynamics that have fed the narrative that Iran, with U.S. support, is transforming into a regional power will not change. This agreement is narrowly focused addressing very specific non-proliferation concerns that were a paramount concern as recently as November 2013. So he concludes, thus on its non-proliferation merits, the deal is a win for the United States. However, it will not pave the way for easy answers to the region's numerous crises. It may, in fact, make them more difficult to solve. Now, that is exactly what happened. So, the interesting part of all of this, and again, written by a guy named Aaron Stein, comes out of War on the Rocks. The interesting part about all this is, so we're reading this narrative that the United States withdrew from the JPOA, right? Well, the United States isn't bound by the JPOA. We had a president who signed it, just like Bill Clinton signed the Kyoto Accord. And it was never submitted to the Senate to be ratified. So what is it? Answer, it's a president's intention for American foreign policy. That's it. That's as much weight as it carries. So, again, I did some education last night. As you could tell, I decided to share it with you. And, it's just, so you enter into a treaty that you know the Senate's not going to ratify. What is the point? Right? And then you have a big handshake ceremony, and it's not ever going to be part of American law. What's the point? So, again, this thing that we see, and then overlay it on Iran today, right? We see the United States pulling out. Iran agrees, it has agreed to this restrictive covenant, right? And let's assume for the sake of discussion that this duality exists. That the fundamentalists that run the Iranian Revolutionary Guards don't answer to the president. They pursue their own agenda. So their point of view is, hey, we are going to restore Persian dominance in the Middle East. And we're on our way through our proxies. That agreement is a problem for us. It's a problem because the United States withdrawing from it and putting those sanctions back on destabilizes the nation. And when the nation destabilized our little power play here is at risk. So we have to do something about it. And what you're seeing in the Middle East is what they're doing about it. We have to create a series of events designed to put the United States in a perilous position. Perilous position with its allies, controversial position at home. And I would say, if I were them, I would go as far as to say this. And it's not even aimed at Donald Trump. Although it kind of is a little bit. What it's really aimed at is the American electorate and getting Donald Trump out of there. So we can get somebody who's a little bit easier to deal with, and then we'll cut a deal with them, right? The longer game that the totalitarian regimes play. So all these made-for-TV events designed to make Donald Trump look like a fool. Now, here's the, again, and so here's what we're going to do on the show today. I want you to listen to foreign voices talk about this issue. Okay? Again, the treaties thing I just find curious. You look down the list of treaties that have been, we've signed and never ratified. Right? It's a long list. And again, for good reason. So we're a signator, so we kind of sort of are in on it, but we're really not bound by it. That's how we do it. All right. So what we'll do is I want to listen to some commentators from the BBC talk about. We're going to listen to that. And we're also going to listen to Al Jazeera. You're going to hear kind of a roundtable. You're going to hear somebody who's clearly pro-Iranian talk about how you can never trust the United States. Right? You're going to talk about somebody who served, I want to say, in the Obama administration. And she says some pretty surprising things, too. And then you're going to hear a guy in there is from London, and you're going to hear what he has to say. So we're going to hear foreign voices today after we do the news, which I think is interesting, right? And I think fundamental to being good at something is knowing your enemy. And in order to know your enemy, you've got to study him. You got to listen to him. You got to know him. If you don't know him, study him, any of that, then can't do it. So, with all that said, good morning to you. You're on a Tuesday. The United States Marine Corps band makes it official. Good morning. This is dedicated to everybody who listens. Thanks for listening. Probably don't do this often enough, but this whole experience is pretty humbling as after, you know, into our fourth year. So for everybody that listens to this on a regular basis, your support, your suggestions, and your participation is appreciated. Know that.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front, with his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City. Standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
Here's an email. Mac, this show's going to make me angry. I know it is. I think it's good to hear what other people are saying, right, about the United States. And Al Jazeera, go figure. I've listened to it once, so you'll find it interesting. I promise you, or else I wouldn't play it. Mostly cloudy in 84 in Quantico. Sunny in 89 at Camp Lejeune. Sunny in 86 at Marine Corps Base 29 Palms. Clouds in 62 at Camp Pendleton. Dark cloudy in 77 degrees. I'm sorry, dark raining in 77 degrees at Camp Smith in Hawaii. In Okinawa, it is dark, cloudy, and 79 degrees. In Ramadi in Iraq, it is sunny and 109 degrees. In Lashkar Gah in the Helmand province of Afghanistan, it is dark, clear, and 92 degrees. At the home of Ball Marine Radio here in Southern California, it is cloudy and 63. Looking for a high of only 69 degrees today, 71 tomorrow, 73 on Thursday, all with clouds in the sky. That is a look at your weather this morning. Good morning, Matt. Congratulations on the fourth year. I'm sitting in my boat fishing and listening. Semper Fidelis. Thanks, Johnny boy. Good luck with that fishing thing. Here's another one. I, too, want a second what somebody else has wrote. I can feel my blood starting to boil when I hear Al Jazeera. No, I just listen to it. Look, the guy who's pro-Iranian, clearly, yeah, I mean, that's easy, right? That's easy. But, no, it's just, it's what the others say, right? It's what the others say. And part of it is the fact that people hate Donald Trump. There are other parts, though, that are interesting parts of the issue, right? That are interesting parts of the issue. Where does this go? Iran back down? And looming behind all of it, that mascot for the Philadelphia Phillies, the Philly fanatic, that dude, like, not exactly subtle, right? So any place that thing goes, it's pretty noticeable. Okay, that is Israel looming. Someplace in the room, someplace in the area. Like, everybody else has an opinion. Israel's going to act. Okay? Israel's going to act. And somewhere, in some part of the Israeli government, every day that issue gets updated. Every day. So it's part of what makes... It's part of what makes this issue different. So anyway, we're going to talk about it. We'll check some news headlines. The boxer is in the vicinity of the Indian Ocean. The boxer holds the 11th Mew. And so here's a question for you. The boxer, is it named after Barber Boxer? No, it's not. What's the boxer? Who's the boxer named after? Been around forever. It was one of the ships we captured that was a British ship in the War of 1812. Okay. Yeah, so we keep it on our rolls just to let the Brits know. That's right. We stole your shit. We were sailing around the world. Anyway, we'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Just everybody relax, okay? All you're going to do is get educated a little bit. That should not be a traumatic experience.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com. and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good, but are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Yeah, Colleen got in trouble last night. So we're going to go to a movie. Friends pick her up at 6. Movie starts at, what, 7? Uh-huh. So she texts me, the movie's not going to be over till later than I told you. Okay, so what time are you going to be home? She said you'd be home at 9, and we would have dinner at 9, which I was okay with.
And when a traffic filler break down in nowhere, so I can find me crying tears when I...
So she replies, 10:45. I said, yeah, that doesn't work for me. We don't make 2-hour mistakes, okay? She said, okay, I'll be home right after the movie. So then she gets home at 9:30. I said, what happened at 10:45? She goes, oh, I made a mistake. That's why you, your kid should be good at math, okay? Alright, headlines, Stars and Stripes. David Bellavia to receive Medal of Honor for actions inside Nightmare House in Fallujah on November 10th, 2004. The fighting kicked off on, I want to say, November 8th. So he will receive the Medal of Honor for actions in Iraq and will be the first surviving Medal of Honor recipient from the war in Iraq. Next headline. Iran says path to diplomacy is permanently closed after new sanctions on its leader. Today, Iran sharply criticized a new round of U.S. sanctions targeting the Islamic Republic's supreme leader and other top officials, saying the measures spell the permanent closure of diplomacy between the two nations. So, we'll see where this goes. Another big headline, Stars and Stripes, right? They're doing they do a podcast, right? And the podcast right now is devoted to, It's entitled Force for Hire. So it talks about contractors. Headline, episode 12. A talk with Tim Lynch, voice of a misunderstood industry. Tim Lynch, retired Marine infantry officer turned contractor, joins us to talk about his experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, from the mundane to the extraordinary. His insights, thoughts, and observations make this episode one of the most dynamic of the season. You won't want to miss it. Yeah! Oh, Doc Lynch! Tearing it up in Stars and Stripes. Nice going. The acting Secretary of Defense and the SecDef nominee, Secretary Esper, heads to Europe, where he will meet with NATO defense ministers. So, headline, Allied spending up, Russian weapons on the agenda as Esper meets NATO defense ministers. So, and then the other story is the Boxer arrives in Fifth Fleet waters amid tensions with Iran. So, again, the 11th Mu. It replaces the Kearsarge. I don't know if I'm saying that right. No, I'm nervous. See, my phobia about names. Once I mispronounce it once, right, I don't feel good about myself. I don't feel good about anything. USNI story. Acting SecDef Esper's first message to the Pentagon. So this is a memorandum for all Department of Defense employees. Subject, initial message to the department. He essentially emphasizes three things. One, build a more lethal force. Okay. The surest way to deter adversary aggression is to fully prepare for war. He goes on. Number two, strengthen alliances and attract new partners. Our allies and partners play an essential role in helping us deter conflict and defend freedom around the world. That's important. Number three, reform the department for greater performance and affordability. So, Esper has previously served in the United States Army, the National Guard, and the United States Army Reserve. So, he's got a pretty full resume. And like I said yesterday that everything I've ever seen of that guy, he's, a fucking Ohio man. You know, he is like the pronunciation, the ship pronunciation, like Jackass. Kearsarge, you said it right. You are trainable. No, now it's in my head. Like, I hesitate every time I see that shit. Okay, not to digress, we continue. Marine Corps headlines. Now, there's a whole bunch of non-stories. You know, one about night vision goggles. A couple about the kid who drove into a bunch of former Marines and killed them. Part of a motorcycle club in New England. Organizations handing out t-shirts. We attack Iran's computer system. Blah, blah, blah. The one, though, that is interesting is a picture that was taken recently of the 3rd Marine Air Wing at Miramar. And it's got all these empty platforms rotating on the tarmac. And I don't know. It's a lot. Headline, despite massive shows of air power, nearly 40% of Marine Ospreys are not mission capable. And then the article goes on to quote different spokesmen as explaining why, 40% really pretty good. Right? I don't know about you, but, sorry, boys. That dog ain't gonna hunt for me. In mid-June, the Marine Corps put on a stunning display of air power when dozens of MV-22 Ospreys and CH-53s elephant walked into a tight formation at Miramar Naval Air Station, Marine Corps Air Station Miramar, Less than a week later, tilt rotors and heavy lift helicopters aboard Camp Lejeune carried Marines into one of the Corps' largest air assault exercises in a decade. But as the Marine Corps flexes its airlift muscles, hiding in the background are a large number of Marine Ospreys that are not mission capable due to maintenance issues and staffing shortages, according to military officials. Now, the article goes on to explain each one of those in nuance, but and then why 40%, you know, is not bad. Trust me, 40% is bad. And people can make all the excuses they want, but you know what? We've been in this trough for years, and it's supposed to get fixed. And, you know, General Neller has spent his entire, you know, reign as commandant dealing with aviation readiness. And so I would say this. If you can't turn a readiness issue around in 4 to 6 years, I don't think it's a readiness issue. Yeah, I think it's a leadership issue. Yeah, how about that one? All right, so top five stories in Early Bird look like this. Number one, Trump level sanctions against Iran with a warning. Number two, Iran threatens more attacks on U.S. drones as Pompeo visits the region. That's from the Associated Press. Number three, yeah, Iran says, like, we could have shot down an aircraft that had 35 people on it. Like, oh, what, we're going to send that one over Iranian airspace? Stupid. Number three, but again, let me just tell you, when you hear the audio that I'm going to play for you, you know, you'll see the way this plays out in front of the world is very different from the way it plays out here in the United States. Number three, Esper lays out priorities in first message to the force as acting SecDef. Number four, what is an advanced Russian warship doing in Havana Harbor? What do you think it's doing? Come on. One, it's tweaking the nose of the United States. Two, it's gathering. It's what they do. They collect everywhere. Number five, Trump, I do not need congressional approval to strike Iran. That is true. That is true. Everybody knows it. All right. Now, we'll take a quick break here because we just took one. That's kind of a look at the news. But this whole thing with Iran, again, the JPOA, right, P5 plus one, blah, 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 right? A treaty that was never ratified, that the Obama administration liked, but knew they couldn't get through the Senate. So it has zero chance of becoming law in the United States. But somehow or other, we answer for it. That's how it works. Right? So, anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you're going to hear what people think about it, about this issue. We'll go to the UK. You'll hear a couple different segments from the BBC. And then we'll go to Al Jazeera that is doing a bit of a roundtable on this issue. Right? So, anyhow, don't touch that dial. You'll find it interesting. I promise you, you won't even have to take your blood medication. Although the one dude you might have to take, not a full dose, but maybe a partial dose of your blood pressure medication. Because he's like straight up like an Iranian spokesman, I think. So, more of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.